went out of its way to stop at stoplights, you know, to let people cross. It's so wrong. And I think it raises profound questions. Not, you know, you can get angry about all this, but I think it raises profound questions about whether Governor Walker really begins to understand what he's talking about as regards global threats, but also begins to understand how a president should look at the people he would serve.
Final question. We only have 10 seconds. Back to our first story, FCC, the major decision around net neutrality. You said you debated Tim Wu over whether the term net neutrality should be the one that was used a decade ago.
You started the show with Tim Wu, and Tim did not blow his horn hard enough. He and I have both been involved for a long time with the group Free Press, and Tim really was the person who argued for using the term net neutrality so we understood the internet, and that it had to be neutral with all forces. He was a profound figure in this. And frankly, you couldn't have picked a better guest to start the show with.
Well, thank you, John Nichols, political writer for The Nation, author of Uprising. That does it for our broadcast. Democracy Now! Has a job opening, a part-time camera operator to work on our live broadcast here in New York. Go to democracynow.org for more information. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Renee Fell, Sarah Mache, Namin Sheikh, Steve Martinez, Sam Alkoff. I'm Mimi Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
This is WHFR, Dearborn, the station making waves from Henry Ford College. And now it's time for our public affairs show, and we call it the new WHFR Journal. Hello and welcome to another edition of the new WHFR Journal. My name is Jay Koronek. Happy to be with you here today. It is, well, it's the end of the month already. Of course, February is a short month, usually, always shorter than 30 days anyway. And this month is only 28 days. Today is February the 27th, 2015. And we're doing the show live. Now, if you're listening, of course, to our podcast, which is available to be listened to anytime from our website, whfr.fm, just click on Talk Shows and then select WHFR Journal and then select the desired date of the show that you want to hear. And, of course, some of the things we say will be already have happened. Today it's true. One of the things we're going to be talking about is something that's already passed, and that is the State of the City address from Mayor O'Reilly here in Dearborn. It happened 2 days ago on Wednesday, the 25th of February. It's kind of interesting because we were told, as were all the media, that we could not publicize that event. We could not promote it, even though, yes, it was open to the public, but it's in the new Dearborn Administrative Center where the Chamber Council is the room that they're using, a converted multipurpose room from the former owners, only holds about 80 chairs, and they're not comfortable ones, folks. Of course, a few people in the community have raised the question, well, why didn't they just have it at the center, you know, Ford Community and Performing Arts Center? Well, I guess it looks a little bad to have 1,200-seat auditorium filled with only about 50, 60 people. But, you know, should you try to accommodate as many as possible? Should you promote public attendance at such an event? One of the benefits is, other than the speech, is actually being able to meet some of your elected representatives before and after. Wouldn't it be great to have it at the center and actually have a somewhat larger reception where people could, you know, talk to elected representatives back and forth a little bit? There was a little appetizer reception afterwards, but they didn't tell the press about it, and so a lot of us didn't even look over to the corner of the entrance room from the west, the most west side door facing south on the Dearborn Administrative Center from the parking lot. And so I didn't get any snacks because I didn't realize until I left the second or third time, I kept forgetting things, that there actually was food over there. And that's kind of important to me. But I did get a chance to talk to some of the elected representatives, politicians, people from committees, business, and so on. And I'll make comments after we play the complete State of the City address. And it's going to be coming up in just a moment here. Just two caveats. One is that there's some audio quality problems. One is because they were using only one microphone that was what's called in the business unidirectional. It was very selective, and they put it right in front of the mayor, but he had his teleprompter screens placed to his somewhat farther right and farther left. So it looks like when he was reading the script, he was actually looking around the room and making eye contact with the people sitting there. In fact, he was looking at his scripts on these two teleprompter screens back and forth. So anytime he turned to the right or turned to the left, his voice level dropped off significantly in the recording. So if you wonder why we're always going up and down in volume there, we had to, for technical reasons, could not set up our own equipment because they didn't have a podium this year. We could not record it ourselves. We had to take a feed from one of their recorders, which used that single microphone. So everything, whether it's a video that you see on CDTV, on one of the local cable channels, or at the cityofdearborn.org website, they all have that same audio problem because the mayor kept turning left and right, and that's okay to do that. It just actually, there's a way to perform so you don't lose the levels, but nobody told him that he needed to perform in a way, move in a way that wouldn't drop the level, even if he wanted to turn left or right. It's, you know, I teach those sorts of things here, big time college classes, and, you know, most politicians don't have the time to take those classes. Nonetheless, it was a well-written speech, and if you want to read it for yourself, it's a 17-page PDF file that's at cityofdearborn.org. The second point I wanted to make is that the mayor also is a very dynamic speaker in the sense he uses a lot of body language, such as his hands. Now, I don't know if there's any Italian blood in him, but oh my gosh, he uses a lot of hand motions to make his points. And that's good. It's very effective to do that for a speaker in front of a crowd. Except he kept hitting the neck, that is where the little microphone was connected to the desktop, which is about 2 or 3 feet long, and it was right in front of him. And so every time he turned to the right or left and had his hands out, gesturing in some appropriate way, he would hit the microphone. So it's 36 minutes long here. We're going to start it right now. If you want to pay more attention to the speech, here's a trick. Also, besides taking notes, as I already have, I'll help you with that afterwards, count the number of times he hits the microphone. It sounds like a thump, like a thump or a bang of some sort. And it varies a little bit in its quality, but count how many times he does that in this 36-minute speech. And that should also allow you to focus on the other words too, the important part of the speech, of course. So here it goes, Mayor John O'Reilly and Dearborn's State of the City address for 2015.
It's really great for me to be able to talk with you here in the Dearborn Administrative Center and share how this has really made a difference to our customers by improving our ability to serve everyone. It's a solid example of what I want to focus on tonight, how we can succeed with transformative projects if we believe in our vision, we back it up with decisions and good data, and have a realistic perspective, and finally are flexible as conditions are evolving. We understood from the beginning the emotional and logistical elements of moving the heart of our operations out of the City Hall. And we didn't dismiss the connections people felt to the old building. Tonight, interestingly enough, is, and Bev picked the date, I didn't have anything to do with it, but it's would be my father's birthday today. He would have been 97. And And so, you know, it's interesting that coincides with this day, because quite frankly, he was the last mayor that had to survive a recession. So I'm hoping I was channeling him a bit. But we knew this was the right thing to do and the right position for success in the long term. And we had an extraordinary opportunity that we had to seize. Now, for years, we had all the community leaders, from Mayor Hubbard right through every mayor up to myself, had a same vision for a more economical and efficient facility, one that would deliver the same high service levels, but in a more modern and convenient way, and one that would integrate the city's central campus and save us millions of dollars in repairs deferred at the old building, and more importantly, reduce our overhead costs going forward so that every year going forward, we can put more money back into services to serve you. Now, it's no secret that there's some bumps along the way, but it's been 5 months now since we moved in, and I'm very happy with the way things are going. And more importantly, the response I get from all of our customers is that they're extremely positive. Now, it is an outcome that we can be proud of. But I want to spend more time talking about outcomes tonight. You know, it's good to be reminded of just how successful we have been in overcoming challenges, and especially the ones we've faced since I first gave my first state of the city 8 years ago. In that time, because of the recession, there have been historic changes in our economy that affected every family and every business in our community. At the very least, our momentum was interrupted, and we encountered obstacles that we could never have anticipated. In our region, we saw such unprecedented events as the bankruptcy of Detroit, the government bailout of GM and Chrysler, and our own Ford Motor Company, who, instead of taking the bailout, took the hard road and paid their bills and got it done. But the impact for us was that they reduced by tens of thousands the workforce here in Dearborn that was part of our economy and part of our customer base. So, in Dearborn, just like everywhere else, revenues dropped, and every municipality in Michigan faced the same challenges. So, we experienced 8 years of downsizing, both personnel and services, prioritizing our resources, and learning to do as much as possible while still continuing to give good services. And in all of these challenges over the 8 years, we celebrate positive achievements with the support of the City Council and the community. We've stabilized neighborhoods through our aggressive programs to purchase rehab homes. That's brought more homeowners back into our community. We've reached 95% of our target to register every rental property so that we can really, you know, look at how we can use that database to monitor and keep track of our neighborhoods and keep our residential areas strong. We've sold dozens of vacant parcels to adjoining neighbors on small lots that we decided were no longer buildable. And this would create larger side yards. It expanded the size of residential lots to make them more marketable, to make them more attractive to new buyers. People could build driveways, provide off-street parking in areas that were so congested and people couldn't get cars off the streets. We've combined administrative departments, saving the cost of director positions and other overhead. We've changed the direction of the CSO project, so that not only are we meeting the federally imposed mandate to reduce pollution in the Rouge River, but we're doing it in a less expensive and more effective way, and we've an added benefit of new water mains, new roadways, new sidewalks in those same areas, and the cost is cheaper than the caissons we were originally going to do. We've also strengthened our ability to respond to fire and medical emergencies through the beneficial consolidation of our fire department with Melvindale. We can see even greater public service advantages for our residents as we continue to explore a multi-jurisdictional dispatch center that will link communities to each other and to all of our private sector partners that have large security systems. Since conditions made selling Camp Dearborn unrealistic. We instead significantly updated it and added the amenities to help it pay for itself. And that's what it's been doing. For the first time in the history of Camp Dearborn, we've had several years where it paid its own way. Okay, but we also have plans this year for more exciting additions and more things that we think will make it more attractive and make it more desirable to people in the future. Now, we've promoted the promise of more activity in our local economy by facilitating development of student housing at the University of Michigan Dearborn. And there are going to be more units added this year in 2015. So it was successful and we're moving forward with that. We've also increased our connections with community groups, including the Dearborn Area Interfaith Network, which is just an outstanding asset to our community, the Dearborn Federation of Neighborhood Associations. This has helped us expand our ability to get direct input, share information, and amplify resources across the city. Among the outstanding results, we partnered with 2,000 energetic volunteers for an impressive cleanup day in Southeast Dearborn. It was amazing. And then we had another cleanup in the West End, and we're looking forward to using that model and doing more of that because it's been a great partnership in the city and the neighborhoods who say, we want to be engaged, we want to do something. And we've pursued a most exciting project, the Art Space City Hall Lofts, which will create an exceptional destination that promises to transform downtown East Dearborn into a funky, hip, eclectic district. And we've been working toward that for some time. Now, you know, I have to say, I've visited several of these. Most major cities in the United States have art space projects. They're housing, affordable housing for artists. And they're in most of the major metropolitan areas. And when we've gone out and talked to the mayors of these cities, and I've talked to them, and we've talked to the artists themselves, they just talk about how much it does and how much economic flow comes with it. So hold on, we're gonna see how that works, but I'm confident. That's just a sampling of some of the noteworthy outcomes from our initiatives over the last 8 years. Now, as we reflect on our progress, we also welcome the news that economic conditions are improving and more people and businesses are getting back on track. As you'll see in assessment notices mailed out, you know, they're coming this week if you haven't gotten them already. How many already got your assessment notices? Okay. All throughout the city, we saw increases in values. Okay, so they're starting to go up and some very dramatically. And this is reflecting that much healthier real estate market. But it's really important that everybody understand that the city continues to be hurt by Proposal A. That's because the authors of Proposal A failed to ever anticipate that property values could ever drop anywhere near what we've seen. And so over the last 8 years, we've lost so much value, and our city revenues will not return to pre-recession levels for another 10 years. And even when they do get to that level, we'll still be behind because inflation is happening every year, so we're falling further and further behind. And it's not just cities. Any local entity that's supported by property tax, okay, by property tax, has the same impact because the property tax values are capped. So in some areas of our town, for example, we had increases of 20% in value. We had some at 15% and other levels, 10 and so on. But we're capped at the CPI, which is 1.6. So we get 1.6% when property values went up 20%. This is the reality, and it's going to stay that way. So we're always going to be falling further behind. So Dearborn and other cities will face an uphill struggle as the economy recovers. And so other sectors are doing well, but for us, we're not going to do as well. Although one government entity is completely recovered from the recession and is actually ahead in terms of their general revenue, which is the state of Michigan, because they use property tax and sales tax, which both recovered within 2 years. And yet they're still crying that they have a deficit. But amazingly enough, they have more general revenue than they've ever had. I'll leave it at that. Memories will dim about the severity of the years of financial setbacks. But since we don't keep pace with the recovery, our city decisions must be based on our ongoing economic reality. The long-term consequences for our city must always be the top of mind when we look at the ways we are investing our tax dollars. We must leverage them for the most benefits, for the most people, and for the longest term. Now, it's not my style to give easy answers because I think easy answers lead to bad decisions. We're all better off knowing the full story. So it's important to take the time to think about the role of city government and the ways in which we should be spending our finite resources. There are two fundamentally different categories of expenditures. Those services like police and fire, and even road maintenance that are local road maintenance that are local government activities that really are best done by our local governments. And then we can't compromise those. These are crucial services. But then there are services that are more, I'd say, nice to have. They're recreational, historic, I see Jack here, library programs, and so on and so forth. They enhance our quality of life, there's no doubt. But they aren't exclusively offered by communities, and if you don't have the money to do the must-have, they're the ones to go. And we saw that as cities went into trouble, and even before bankruptcies, as cities began to have really serious, some of the cities had serious problems, those were the programs that got put aside. So for the most part, we have only one pot of money to pay for both essential services and the nice-to-have amenities. With limited funds, that can lead to some tough and sometimes agonizing decisions. We know we can't spend the same dollar twice. We must be willing to make those difficult choices so that we don't jeopardize our ability to pay for essential services now or in the future. That's another thing we saw, where people sort of figured out how they could do it in a temporary way, and they only exacerbated the problem and made it worse in the future. We just can't afford to do it. So before we say yes to something that is a popular but discretionary service, we need to have the data in front of us that proves there is a revenue stream to support it, or that it has a long-term benefit that will reduce costs in the future, or it's essential to move the community forward in some very discernible way. As mayor and someone who has been entrenched in this special community for six decades, it's impossible and difficult to say no to residents who feel a passion about a particular nice-to-have feature. I wish that the finances were there for us to support all of the traditions and things that people have treasured about our community. But as we think about that, I want to share a timely topical example with you about how financial pressures have played out in one essential service, snow plowing. Luckily tonight, we're not looking at it. We have an excellent reputation of clearing our roads, and I'm proud of our crews. I mean, our staff and our crews do an outstanding job. But so far this winter, we've pretty much been able to maintain the standards. But this is in spite of the fact that we have an ongoing potential of losing half of our fleet at any point because we're just keeping them going. They're challenged. They need a lot of upgrade, and we've been trying to work with them. And this is especially true after last winter. If we had another winter this year like we did last year, I'd be standing here telling you I'm sorry we couldn't get the job done because our equipment wasn't up to it. Now, we have some new trucks. It took a while to get them and get them delivered. They'll be delivered in March. But it's an example of that kind of thing where, we've got to have that stuff to get it done. We have to have the roads be safe. We have to make sure people can get where they need to be. And so those are things. So we nonetheless have to put in, we have to put in we have to focus on how we're going to use management and foresight so that we can put in, we can do what we can do even if it's less than ideal. Okay. Now, we've monitored this closely and have replacement trucks, as I said. But, you know, this is not the only way we like to operate. We'd prefer to do long-range planning, which we do. We do a three-year budget. We're trying to look out 5, even 10 years. But if we face this situation for a crucial service like snow plowing, then it puts in perspective the need to proceed with caution programs that are less impactful. And we will remain open to pursuing opportunities that have greater return on our investment and serve the most residents and fit into longer-term strategy for Dearborn and make it attractive to families. Because at the end of the day, what we're really looking at is not only keeping everyone here happy and to deal with what they really need, but we're trying to make sure that the reputation we have draws new business investment and new residential families. Now, any investment decisions must be justified by a thorough analysis of the true costs and the true benefits that we need every tax dollar to work as hard as it can to produce the greatest overall value. Now, there are select services that we'll always invest in and for which we will never compromise, and those include police and fire services. Our combined fire department has done a tremendous job with meeting the needs of the community and responding to increased demand for EMT services. It's implemented modern approaches to fire protection, its shared services, and disaster preparedness, and most significantly, medical emergency care. And these initiatives have occurred at the same time the department has experienced a 52% increase in call volumes, in runs, since 2004. So more than half again what we were doing in 2004, we've been doing it successfully. And the amazing thing is that because of the equipment we have on our rigs and the training that we have a higher incidence of survival of heart attacks and strokes, much higher, and recoveries are much fuller because we can treat before we transport. We can, our staff is in contact with the emergency room doctor at the point they arrive at the site to address this individual that's having an episode. And so they can begin, they send EKGs right to them, right from there. The emergency room physician can then look at that EKG and tell them, here's what you should do, administer this, do that, even before secure transport. That's the highest level available anywhere, and we have it for all of our runs. So, I mean, we're way ahead of the curve. That's the kind of thing we have to spend money on, because saving a life or having someone make a fuller recovery is one of the most important things that we can do. Now, more people are also turning to our police department as well. Since 2007, calls for service have increased 22%. So, again, we're seeing that increase. The police department has again done an excellent job of protecting our neighborhoods and business districts and reducing major crime. From 2007 to 2014, we saw the rates of most serious crime drop by 16%. The department also did something unique it's grown. They started Operation Blue Light. Now, it's an initiative that now involves 35 communities and policing agencies, and all of them dedicated extra patrols and to make this work. And that what happens is they go out for 2 weeks into the community, and they're making traffic stops and searching for people who are wanted for warrants on significant crimes. In Dearborn alone, we were able, everybody from the chief through everybody in the department spent time on the road. And during that round, we in Dearborn were able, through our officers, to take 42 people who were wanted for felony warrants off the street. And our officers are also on the block. They come into neighborhoods even when they're not called. So what happens is we have this park and walk. So 3,000 times our police officers parked their car and walked in neighborhoods just last year. And then another 700 school visits. And we had 53 neighborhood watch or crime prevention meetings. So in addition to doing the emergency stuff, we're also out there being proactive. And as our officers are out there day in and day out, they have renewed their promise to treat everyone with respect And even the most difficult circumstances, from 2007 to 2014, the incidence of use of force by our police department dropped 72%. 72%. We're talking about both physical takedowns and tasers, everything. 72% reduction over that period of use of force. They've taken their training seriously, as well as their belief as a police department in a high standard of policing. A better balance has been achieved, and I couldn't be prouder of our officers. The department has been recognized beyond our borders as well. In October, this past October, the International Association of Chiefs of Police honored Dearborn with two prestigious awards, one for its commitment to civil rights, and the other for contributions to quality of life in our community. And that's on an international scale, so it's really dramatic. And like the police, every department is focused on preserving our high service levels and with seizing opportunities that strengthen our vitality. As we move forward towards 2015 and beyond, here are some of the initiatives I want you to know about. We're working closely with Ford Motor Company as it begins major reinvestment over a long period in its engineering complex. This really important project will keep Dearborn and Ford Motor Company at the center of innovation for a long time, meaning we will continue to welcome thousands of well-educated knowledge workers to our city every day. The John D. Dingell Transit Center, we dedicated in December, is more than just a building. It is a gateway to the future of transportation, both for tourists and commuters. It will also be a springboard for continued development and economic development in West Dearborn and beyond. Throughout America, businesses, restaurants, and homes have clustered around these transit centers. And so we expect to see that same thing. You know, we're going to see it. And in East Dearborn, we're promoting arts and culture activities, as I talked about. And we already have a great foundation with arts-based development that's going on. And the project is poised to generate a wealth of activities. 53 units, live-work units for artists, will be put in, and residents will be able to live there, do their work. Many would be adjunct professors, often at some of our colleges and universities, but they will be together, and as I said, I visited these. They're amazing projects. And so we really anticipate that as a catalyst. But there's also going to be a center place where the clerk, treasurer, and that section of the city or of the building that will be dedicated for use, like for galleries, for studios, for entertainment, performance, all kinds of things. So it's going to be a center where it's going to draw public, it's going to draw people in, which is really important. And so we expect this is really going to spur some really exciting opportunities for us and for the use of the whole East Dearborn downtown. And I have to announce, because there's going to be a festive kickoff event for the project on April 21st. So you'll hear more about it, but on April 21st, you'll get to have firsthand knowledge and come and see what's going on. And they're really making progress on the transformation. And finally, we're seeing the properties in West Downtown Dearborn freed up from the impossible legal entanglements after the terrible recession. We are working with a number of investors who are preparing to open new establishments in properties that have been vacant for far too long. Now, you may have noticed recently some, you know, coming soon signs or going up or businesses moving in. All of that is adding to the variety of choices and destinations we're all going to have. Now, we're counting on a very busy schedule of grand openings in the spring and summer. Among the new businesses we are expecting soon are Brome Artesian Hamburger, Peacock Indian Grill, Las Galanas, Noodles Company, the Nar Bar, Crisp Pizza, Dearborn Brewery, the Stadium Restaurant, Alajami West, Hampton Inn, Famous Hamburger, and a little farther west, Holiday Inn Express and Staybridge Suites. We're also happy that existing businesses have invested in the district, like Bailey's Pub and Grill and Kabuki Steakhouse and Sushi. In conjunction with this renewed energy, we are decommissioning user-paid parking in West Dearborn this spring. We want to remove perceived obstacles to investment and inspire former and new customers to take a look, a fresh look, at our district. We're also looking to forward to strengthening our Warren Avenue and Dix Verner districts through creations of corridor improvement areas. And that's going to be a really important piece for those districts to have the ability to do some things to enhance their desirability for customer base. Now, we're actively engaged with the state of Michigan's program called Redevelopment Ready Communities. We're in the first tier of cities going through that. And we're engaged in the Michigan Main Street Project. So we're taking advantage of every opportunity the state is presenting to use that to leverage our opportunities and also to be eligible for grants and so on. And we're happy to be a partner with the Dearborn Area Chamber of Commerce on their new mobile app promoting restaurants, shops, and attractions. And it's called Discover Dearborn, and we're confident that people will do just that because of it. It's already got a lot of people who signed up. It's active this week, right? So Jackie's back there. If you want to know more, you can catch her before she leaves, but it's really a neat app and a neat project, and it's going to be a nice catalyst for getting people engaged and coming to our community. And with the city council encouragement, we have added inspectors in commercial districts to monitor litter, weeds, and do other maintenance violations of customers. And, you know, it's kind of interesting because we want people to feel welcome there. We want them comfortable. But we're also recommitted to a regular schedule of inspecting a commercial property to ensure that the building standards are maintained after the time that it was sale or after initial occupancy. It's true that challenges remain in our commercial areas. And while we can recruit and promote and facilitate investment, ultimately, we can't control the decisions of private investors or their lenders. So, but what we can control is our commitment to providing a business-friendly environment. Now, even more crucial is our commitment to keeping Dearborn residential-friendly. We want to make sure that our neighborhoods stand out. And that means even broader effort at maintaining standards. So more than ever before, we are collecting and applying data to focus our efforts on the most effective manner and drive initiatives and activities that will have the most impact. Now, with the city's council's encouragement again, we are making sure our neighborhoods meet basic standards. We want all of our residents to first understand their obligations to care for their yards and for their houses. So it's an education process. We know that the vast majority of people do take pride in their property. When notified by our inspectors about any issues, residents fix the problem 90% of the time without any further action. Meaning once that our people go out and say, hey, did you know that you have to do this or you can't do that? Over 90% do the job. That makes it easier because now we can go after the less than 10% who we really do have to issue citations or do something. And we renewed our education efforts to help people understand last year why they can't store inoperable vehicles, trailers, and RVs in their residential property. Now, with our first efforts, we were able to clear 970 unwanted vehicles out of our neighborhoods without issuing tickets. That was 97% compliance without issuing tickets. So again, that's that whole thing of, you know, working together and getting out and letting people know this is what we expect, this is the standard, and, you know, getting them to do it without us having to come and get into a more conflicted relationship, let's say. And then, so we have 17 inspectors that are out all the time in our neighborhood and business district, working to spot and resolve these kinds of problems, like outside maintenance. And then we have another set of inspectors that are devoted basically to the internal safety standards, mostly for our homes, but for sometimes businesses too. And to make it easier for residents to follow our trash and recycling rules, we've actually provided 370 additional carts to homes at a modest cost, where they keep overfilling the ones that they were assigned. So we're disciplining that too, because we don't want bags on the ground. We know, you know, garbage bags on the ground are trouble in so many ways. Now, street sweeping is another service that you value. And we've had a little trouble lately, so in 2014, we took a look at it and did a really hard look at how can we best deliver that service in the most efficient and cost-effective way, and expect, and so we are implementing, and this year I can tell you, you can expect to see much better outcomes with much cleaner streets. And you can hold me accountable if it doesn't happen, but I'm going to guarantee it will, right, Dave? But we also enhanced our neighborhood parks by prudently placing security elements and video cameras using Wayne County millage money obtained for us by our Wayne County Commissioner, Gary Warrenchuk. Thank you very much. This is a new way, because now we can go after crimes in the park, because we can go back and get the video and we can look at it. And with the technology you're trying to put in, police officers will have real-time access to see what's going on too, with some of the new equipment we're looking at, the digital stuff. So we're really taking seriously our role too in making sure that the parks are safe. Everybody knows if your children are at the park, we're going to really continue our effort to make sure that we're doing everything I can to send the message, don't mess around in our parks. And we're also building momentum and carefully managing our fiscal challenges. And that will be part of our reality for quite some time, as I pointed out. Though, now through it all, we've endeavored to stay true to our mission of providing you superior public service and earning your trust. But we're also staying true to the fundamental characteristics that have made us such a great, special community. These characteristics, great neighborhoods, great facilities, vibrant commercial areas, and a strong sense of community. We have stood the test of time. They have been and will continue to be the pillars of our collective success. Now, we've changed the building where we conduct our business, but we haven't changed our commitment to serve you well. We're spurring changes in the way our neighborhoods look, but not our goal of making them appealing to you and future home buyers. We're changing our organizational structure, but not our intention of working harder and smarter. We've changed the direction of our single largest public works project, okay, so that we're leveraging all of that investment for a much greater return, and we've changed our operating model in some areas, but not the high service levels and standards that you've come to expect. So we've changed the uses of some of our landmark properties, but not the meaningful contributions they will continue to make in our economic well-being. We're changing processes and procedures, but not outcomes we know you rely on every day. This pattern of making choices in light of necessary change is inevitable, but we don't have to fear it if we can see that the sacrifices required by traditions essentially lead to beneficial outcomes. I've accepted the fact that the person who has to marshal change often bears the brunt of people's emotions. But like my father before me, I accepted this job with my eyes wide open. I also accepted it strongly believing that together we have built something truly remarkable here in this town, something that deserves our total commitment to protect. In light of everything we've gone through and the changes that still lie ahead, nothing will diminish that commitment or my determination to to position our community for the brightest of futures, because that's the Dearborn way, and nothing else will ever change that. We are a one community moving forward together. Thank you.
And there was significant applause after that, although interestingly, there wasn't any applause during the speech from the, well, maybe about 50 or 60 people that were in the room. Again, very few residents that weren't somehow connected to the city. An awful lot of police were there. In fact, both in the room and in the hallways and in the entryway to the Dearborn Administrative Center, I'd say there's another 60 police officers. I'm not quite sure why they needed as many police officers as attendees, unless there were some sort of threats made. Not sure. I just thought, and they were all very nice, very helpful, you know, opening doors when you came in and go out, and they were all very polite, and that's all wonderful, but they were police officers. Why did we need so many police officers? Just wondering about that and a number of things. Okay, quiz time. How many times did Mayor O'Reilly swipe the mic? In other words, hit the mic with his hand or his mouth or whatever. Well, I counted 14 times. That's what I counted. So I don't know what you got, but I hope you listen to the rest of it. Again, it does help to read it in detail. And then in the margins while you're reading it, or if you can't print it out on the screen, have some notepaper next to you and write down some questions, things that you wish he would have talked about but didn't seem to mention. And, of course, this is typical length for the mayor about without the introductions, and I did edit those out. I didn't say it, too. At the beginning, there's 12 minutes or so of introductions of elected representatives and people that were in attendance. Not all the city council members, not all of the school board members, were in attendance. First of all, it wouldn't fit in the room. But, you know, you need to introduce people in that kind of situation, and he did. So I edited those out, and, of course, I usually edit out the applause, because in past speeches, especially at large auditoriums, I remember a couple by Mayor Michael Guido that he gave 10, 12, 15 years ago, a couple of those at the center, again, the large auditorium. He was interrupted by applause about at the end of every paragraph. So I don't know what that tells you, but there was hardly anyone in the room who was there just where didn't already know what the mayor was going to say, let's say. And I'm sorry that we were told not to publicize it, even though it was public information, but we were told not to publicize it. And in fact, none of the Dearborn papers mentioned that moment and the fact that there were seats open to the public that you could sit in. Not many, as it turns out. Okay. Well, moving on, here's some notes that I made, and we have more stories about Dearborn in the last 13, 14 minutes or so today in today's show. Let's see. In terms of guests, at the beginning, I did talk to George Duraney, our Michigan House representative to Michigan's House in Lansing, and he was talking to some people, I overheard this, that he was pro the sales tax. And that's a big issue that all of us have to vote on in Michigan, and all of us locally too, of course. Are you in favor of raising Michigan's sales tax from 6% to 7% to primarily, but not only, fix the roads? And in fact, it's only going to be a partial fix, but it looks like the nature of the legislature is such that they don't want to vote any money for anything, basically. In fact, the new Michigan Republican Party, and I say new because remember, this was put on the ballot by a lame duck session of legislators where there were not as many so-called Tea Party type libertarians or libertarians as in office last December. And so that's why this was put on the ballot for us to vote on now. But in fact, it looks like, and I saw this just a couple days ago, that interviewing the head of the current chairperson of the Michigan Republican Party, who's a woman whose name I've unfortunately gone a blank on, that it looks like the Michigan Republican Party will not even endorse a yes vote on this ballot proposal. And so if it goes back to the legislature, well, the same group in the majority, the Michigan Republican Party, they're not even in favor of spending any money on from the budget on fixing the roads. I don't know how they're going to get fixed otherwise. Mayor O'Reilly would say it's essential. He just got done saying, in fact, in a little part of his presentation that he ad-libbed, I noticed, that the state of Michigan is doing just fine in terms of tax collecting because they don't have any cap on the taxes coming into them. And Dearborn, in terms of property tax, we suffer under Proposition A, which limits us to 1.6% increase a year, and it's going to take quite a while, how many years, even to equal a 10% increase. And I noticed my valuation of my property, you mentioned assessments were sent out this week. I just got mine yesterday in the mail, in fact, not by Wednesday, but yesterday. And, well, to be honest, my property was, assessed a taxable value and so on. It was around $70,000. And it's gone up $12,000. Whoa, that's more than 10%, folks. That's about 15%. But don't worry, we don't have to pay that. We'll only have to pay a maximum increase of 1.6%. So that means that the city, even though values of properties have gone up, the property increase, the tax increase is limited by Proposition A, which a lot of people are saying, get rid of Proposition A. It doesn't apply. It wasn't worded properly, and we've been under it for 30 years, and that was supposedly an idea that whoever wants to in the state, legislators, people, you can't increase by some criteria, whether it's consumer price index or whatever it is, but there's a cap that you can't go over each year. And so your taxes can't instantly go up a lot. Well, city governments would really like it to go up a lot. And interestingly, the revenue sources for the state of Michigan, like income tax and so on, sales tax, there's no cap on those taxes going to the state of Michigan. So Mayor O'Reilly actually snuck in there his comment that the state of Michigan is actually doing really well in this so-called comeback or upswing of property values and business increases in the state of Michigan. But the cities are still being hurt. Now, he didn't address, and let me go on to say at all, the fact that, remember, we have a temporary millage increase in place that we passed, I think, in 2008 or 2009. It was only going to be, I think, 5 years. I think it's coming up, or 7 years or something like that. Anyway, it'll be coming up for renewal in a couple of years. It'll be expiring in a couple of years. Are we going to renew it? Or do we go to some other kind of situation? Now, if we could just go at the state level and repeal Proposition A, well, that would take care of all the funding problems for all the cities. They would really, of course, there'd be a massive increase of taxing for people back to previous levels. Back to the 2007 levels, folks, that's all. You know, if your home values are going up, isn't it only fair to have the taxes going to the city like they used to also? Of course it is. I mean, it's logical. You really don't want it to happen. Nobody wants to spend more money on anything. But as the mayor said, there are some things that are totally essential and can't be paid for in the current situation. So whenever, and I'm going to ask him, Mayor O'Reilly is scheduled to be on this show for most of the hour. He's going to try to get here as quickly as he can after 1 o'clock, and it'll be Friday the 17th of April. So April 17th, Mayor O'Reilly is scheduled to be on this show, and that's one of the many questions that have come from his State of the City address I want to ask him, and that is, when does that supplemental millage run out, and what do we do then? Do we wait and see? Again, if somebody state level could actually do something, like our legislators, or even if we could get on the ballot again, Proposition A, up or down, you know, do you want to eliminate Proposition A? If you do, whoa, all the cities will be able to get the money that they deserve, that they used to get from property values before 2007 and before. And would we need the renewal of the supplemental millage then? No, we wouldn't. No. Will we need to consider some other more extreme measure like a city income tax that we currently don't have in Dearborn only? Well, we have to consider something. We can't keep cutting. Someone said we've gone for over 4,000 employees. Was it Mayor O'Reilly in the speech? How soon, I forget. That was the high water mark of employees, about 4,000 some for the city of Dearborn. I think that was full time. And now we're down to just a few more than 500 full time. Of course, we have a lot more part timers, but they don't cost as much. But they do so much more for so little pay. But they're helping, of course, to keep the city going that way. Anyway, Durrani is pro for it. We won't get a time to look at it in detail, but in this, I think it's Wednesday's Dearborn Press and Guide from the 25th, Tom Watkins, our education information person, consultant, because he formerly was the state of Michigan superintendent of all the schools, or something like that. And then he was pushed out, fired by Jennifer Granholm. You can't fire him, but she got him out of there. Nonetheless, he has had opinions on education, and some are very good opinions that we follow in the Press and Guide over the years. He has an editorial this week asking you to vote yes on Proposition 1. So he and George Durrani vote yes. George also said that in the House, out of about 50 Democrats last December, 48 supported the idea of sending it to the voters. So, because they couldn't do anything else anyway. The Republican majority was what really made the decision, not anyone else. I saw Judge Mark Summers there, along with Judge Salami of the 19th District Court. You know, in the papers this week, a story about how the latest federal appeals court decision is that they say, well, you know, the ruling holds in terms of the unjust firing of an employee at 19th District Court. Her name then was Pucci, and she's now the wife of Judge Hultgren. And so definitely a conflict of interest now. So she's in some other department for the city of Dearborn, thanks to that ruling. But who's going to pay? And that hasn't been really decided. In fact, Summers was quoted in the paper at the end of the article, and this was in the Times Herald from this last Wednesday, that he thinks there's still grounds for appeal. And that would be good for, you know, whoever not having to pay. The last ruling, it looks like Circuit Court said that the city of Dearborn is not responsible for paying. Seemed to indicate the state was responsible for paying, but that's not decided either. Of course, another option would be, would it be Mark Summers himself personally? Of course, that would be individually devastating. His point, and it's always good to point out his side of things, I mean, fair and balanced, right? Is that there's another criteria that the last ruling did open up, that there was perhaps unfairness in one of the big trials because they didn't allow enough chance for the defense, his defense, 19th District Court's defense, to talk about the fact that he did it for pretty much required reorganization and cost-cutting procedures. I mean, at this point, it seems like Julie Pucci, the former Julie Pucci, said, oh, you told me this, you were doing it because of this. And he said, no, I wasn't. I was doing it for this reason. And it doesn't seem like there's any evidence of who said what, actually. So it looks like most of the juries took Julie Pucci's opinion, maybe based on some other things. Circumstantial evidence about other things. But I know that Summers, when he was appointed by the state of Michigan to be the justice in charge of the 19th District Court, he was under a lot of pressure from city council. Cut costs, raise the fines, get efficiencies in there, just like the city of Dearborn. Listen to the pressure of Mayor O'Reilly on all of these entities in the city. cut costs, lay off people. Try to keep the services just as good, though, but maybe some things that aren't essential we got to get rid of. And to heck with traditions that you're used to, we just can't afford it. We just don't have the money. We got to keep doing the essential things, and the other things are just optional. So what you going to do? You know, I think I do not think he's had that point of view has had full hearing in court. And, of course, the question of who pays is still there. But that's a side issue from the actual presentation. Just in the few minutes remaining here, did get a chance to meet for the first time Susan DiBaggio, the city council president. Got the most votes running for council in the last election, and going to try to get her in here on the Journal to ask her about her first year on the council and how it's been going. Looking down my notes here, also wanted to mention, so the city's working with Ford Motor Company about reinvestment. They're reinvesting things in a research and engineering complex. That's wonderful. What does the city have to do with that? That's all Ford property. Ford owns all the property. What's the city have to do with that? I'm thinking tax relief? Is it time to give them more tax reduction, tax rebates, whatever you call it? Tax credits? I've never been in favor of tax credits, but I know it. You know, Ford threatened years ago, decades ago. It was terrible, but they were actually, not officially, but very unofficially, telling everybody, we'll move the Ford World Headquarters out of Dearborn if you don't give us this tax reduction that we're suggesting for something. I don't know, for the Rouge plant or, you know, whatever it was. We'll take our headquarters and move. So, you know, city council waffled, of course. So as long as there are other states and cities that are willing to not tax certain businesses at all, then there's you know, there's a chance that, you know, we could lose Ford Motor Company someday. So I'm just wondering what he meant by they're helping Ford with this reinvestment. Ford obviously doesn't want to do it without tax credits. I know their lawyers are constantly looking for that. West Dearborn, I have to say, personal note, I've for many years ate at the Peacock Indian restaurant. I don't know if it was called a grill or not. In the olden days, I was in East Dearborn. They're one of the best Indian food restaurants in this area. We're talking about Indian food from India, okay? And it was just fantastic. It was wonderful, but they had a couple fires and they closed on the east side, just a little bit south of the old City Hall location. And so they're opening somewhere in West Dearborn, so I'm going to check that out. I don't think we need more burger places, but what the heck. And when is paid parking going to be decommissioned in West Dearborn? This spring. Well, what's the criteria? They have to shovel the snow there first before they can take the parking meters out? What's holding that up? Why does that to be this spring? And they talked about street sweeping. What about street fixing? We've got potholes in local streets here in Dearborn that would swallow some of the snowplow machines, I think. And one of the streets in bad shape, as the mayor well knows, is his street, Park Street, in West Dearborn. Military, just south of